up, you will see in your little flyer that the notes are the first session, the sanctity of life, people made in God's image. I'm starting off man as man, male and female. The individual unit, male and female. Then we're going to talk about man in the second session as a sexual creature, the gift of gender, male and female, homosexuality, bisexuality, procreation, and the family. And then in the third session, we're going to talk about man as a social being in that wider context, the church, the Christian community, the wider community, neighborhood, region, country, and the world, our relationship to the physical environment, the role of government, church-state issues, religious freedom, and war and peace. And we'll leave plenty of time for questions. But let's start off by looking at Genesis chapter 1. Genesis is the book of beginnings. And in Genesis chapter 1, God reveals to us in verses 26 and 27, and God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. Now, everything else really flows from our understanding and our acceptance of this essential truth. Contrary to what the prevailing and dominant view is in America and in Western society in the secular realm, we are not just the most highly sophisticated mammals that by the luck of the draw scrambled our way to the top of the food chain. We are not just highly sophisticated mammals that beat out the chimps and the higher apes by the luck of the draw. There is a difference in kind, not a difference in degree, between human beings and all the rest of creation. Now, it has been noted by others, including several significant Darwinian evolutionists, that the most systematic attempt to apply the theories of Darwinian evolution to human society took place in Nazi Germany between 1933 and 1945. If we are just the most highly sophisticated mammals, then what the Nazis did, really, how do you declare it to be wrong? Survival of the fittest. They believed that the Germanic genetic pool was the greatest, was the most fit. So they began to eliminate what they considered to be inferior genetic pools. They took the then reigning ideas about genetics and how to improve species to improve Homo sapiens. Now, why is that wrong? Because we're human beings. We're not just the most highly sophisticated mammals. We are created in God's image. And even after the fall, God's fingerprints are all over us. And this boils down, and I'm going to be talking about this next month, in Killeen at Fort Hood, there the titanic struggle going on in America today, and it impacts every one of you and your grandparents and your parents and your siblings and your spouse and your children and your grandchildren. Every American, born and yet to be born, is going to be impacted enormously by this debate. And it is the debate between the sanctity of human life versus the quality of human life debate. Now, our country was founded on a belief in the sanctity of all human life. Now, have you ever, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a tremendous debate that goes on between liberals and conservatives over the founding documents of our country. I once was involved in a meeting where they brought half conservatives and half liberals together to come up with a common statement on the founding of the United States. And I was sick as a dog. I had 102 degrees fever. I was just feeling miserable. And I wasn't going to go. And one of my conservative friends called me and said, "You've got to go." He said, "If you don't go, we don't have an even number. You got to go." He said, I'll nurse you while you're there. You got to go." So I went, and I will say, pharmaceuticals are wonderful things. And we ended up for 15 minutes debating the sentence ever since the founding documents of the United States. Because the liberals didn't want documents, they wanted document. They wanted the Constitution. They didn't want to include the Declaration of Independence. Why? Because the Declaration of Independence mentions God quite prominently. Well, in spite of being sick, God gave me inspiration, and I won the debate with this statement. I said, "You know, when Abe Lincoln got up at Gettysburg in 1863 and said, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, if you subtract from 47 from 1863, you get 1776. Abe Lincoln believed the country was founded by the Declaration. I vote that we vote with Abe Lincoln." The Declaration of Independence is the sine qua non, the reason for being for the United States. The Constitution is the implementing document. The Declaration was 1776. The Constitution was 1788. We had the Articles of Confederation before we settled on the Constitution. And what does the Declaration say? "We believe that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now, when they said that we believe that we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, and one of those was life, they didn't just pull that out of the air. They got it from the Bible. A significant number of them were ministers. Now, yes, it is true that a tiny minority of the most famous were not Orthodox Christians, but they were far from agnostics. Thomas Jefferson, they say Thomas Jefferson was a deist. He wasn't a deist. A deist is somebody who believes that God is some great watchmaker who designs the world and then puts it off in space to unwind by itself. This is the same guy who said that he trembled for America when he looked at the way America treated the slaves, that it was written in God's book that the slaves were to be free. That's not an uninvolved God. You read Jefferson, and Jefferson believed in a God who got involved in the affairs of men, and for whatever reason, he was particularly interested in the United States of America. What he was a Unitarian on steroids. He didn't believe in the deity of Jesus, but he did believe in the God of the Bible who got involved in the affairs of men. And I think that would be a very fair way to talk about Franklin as well. But Franklin and Jefferson were infamous in their own time for being a tiny minority who weren't Trinitarians. George Washington was a vestryman at his Christ Church, Episcopal Church, his whole adult life, and attended every Sunday that he was in residence at Mount Vernon. And John Adams and the others, they were Trinitarian Christians. Now, were they born-again Christians like we think of born-again Christian? Well, as your pastor would tell you, you'd have to have a personal conversation with them. You know, you got to have a personal conversation with somebody to understand if they've made the jump from accepting Jesus as the Savior to accepting Jesus as their Savior. We believe that Christianity ultimately is a first-person singular relationship. It's you and God, personally. And you would have to have a conversation with them. But many of these people, clearly, if you read their diaries and stuff, they had a personal relationship with Jesus. But they all were operating out of a biblical worldview. That's why they said that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, an unalienable right is a right that you can't give away, a right that can't be taken away, a right that can't be sold. Ironically, that's why American chattel slavery was the most vicious form of slavery in the Western world, where slaves were reduced in law to the level of property. They were not human beings. Why? Well, if you believe that all human beings are created equal and they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, then the only way that you can live with slavery is to say that slaves aren't human beings. I mean, otherwise, it's a totally inconsistent, contradictory set of worldviews. And so, ironically, this assertion of the sanctity of human life led to the devaluing of the lives of slaves in order to live with the inconsistency. But a life that is in which we get, is ingrained in us, it's an inherent part of who we are. We have the right to life because we're human. Whether we're healthy or we're sick. Whether we're wanted or we're not. Whether we're handicapped or we're not. Whether we're mentally and physically challenged or we're not. Whether we're terminally ill or not, we have the right to life because we're human beings. And in such a society, there are some things that must not be done to a human being. Now, what we have now assaulting that view on every front is an ethic called a quality of life ethic that says that human beings can decide for themselves and for other human beings when some human beings have fallen below the threshold that they have a sufficient quality of life to continue to protect it and to continue to nourish it and to continue to sustain it. When the quality of life ethic triumphs, society becomes a very dangerous place to be. Unless you're already born, unless you're young, healthy, and productive, and able to defend yourself. And I would point out, there was the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Secretary Reich. He went to UCLA, gave a speech in which he said, we're going to curb medical costs because we're not going to continue to pay the enormous medical costs that are run up in the last 2 years of life, most people's lifetime medical expenses are about 30 or 40% of those total expenses come in the last 2 years of life. And he says, we're just not going to pay that anymore. And all the students applauded. Somebody needed to point out to them, they're going to meet their last 2 years of life someday. All you've got to do to be not productive and to be old and to be handicapped and to be sick and to be terminally ill is just live long enough. And when you have a quality of life ethic, you basically have adopted the ethic of primitive cultures that abandon the old to die of exposure or just eliminate them. The Nazis, one of the first things they did was begin to kill people that were in mental institutions. To begin to kill them. The first 10,000 people that were killed in the Holocaust were not Jews. They were 10,000 mentally challenged German children who were sent to take showers, gassed, and burned in ovens because they didn't meet the Nazis' definition for, they were considered, now this is a phrase worth conjuring with, lebensentwertes Leben. Lives unworthy of life. They made an arbitrary decision that some people had lives unworthy of life, and so they exterminated them. Mentally handicapped, physically handicapped, those that they considered to be racially and ethnically inferior, those they considered to be sexually deviant, they just eliminated them. They had lives unworthy of life. They were called useless eaters. And if you adopt the Darwinian theory of evolution and human beings are just animals, how do you object to that? We object to it because human beings are not merely animals. There's a difference in kind. There's a fire break wider than the Grand Canyon between human beings and the rest of creation. It is only human beings that we are told are created in the image of God. Now, the Jews understood this. When it comes to the question of abortion, who's the most defenseless of human beings? Babies that are still in the womb. Every civilization in the Mediterranean basin practiced infanticide, the killing of newborns, and abortion, the killing of preborns, except the Jews. The Egyptians did it. The Assyrians did it. The Phoenicians did it. The Greeks did it. The Romans did it. Abortion was commonplace in the Roman Empire, and the killing of infants was commonplace in the Roman Empire. Will and Ariel Durant, in their 10-volume history of Western civilization, say that in the first century A.D., when Christianity came into the Roman Empire, that it was approximately 9 out of 10 girl babies, after the first girl baby was safely delivered into a family and was healthy, they would kill the girl babies at birth. Because, you know, women weren't considered as valuable as men. So they just kill them. Just kill them at birth. If the father had absolute say, let it live or kill it. When Christianity came into the Roman Empire, getting its revelation about God from the Old Testament, the first post-apostolic teaching of the church, called the Didache, which was published in 134 A.D. Now, think about that. John, the last of the living apostles, probably died right around 100 A.D. And by the way, he's my new hero. I figure that he was at least 98 years old when he was kicking up such a ruckus for Jesus that the emperor had to exile him to Patmos. Man, I want to be like John. John goes home to be with the Lord somewhere between 98 and 100 A.D. 134 A.D., the first post-apostolic teaching of the church. In a Roman Empire where abortion is commonplace, says, the killing of infants in the womb is murder most foul and is beyond the pale for anyone who would name the name of Christ. And by the time Christianity became the dominant faith in the Roman Empire, abortion was illegal in most cases and stayed so in Western civilization until the fall of the Christian consensus in the 20th century A.D. Now, why did the Jews not abort? Because their God, who happened to be the one true God, had made it very clear to them that he's involved whenever conception takes place. God never created a nobody. Everybody is a somebody to God. Now you look at Jeremiah chapter 1. God says to Jeremiah, Jeremiah, before you were in your mother's womb, I knew you. Now, I want to point out to you, he doesn't say, I knew about you. He uses the verb for personal relationship. Before Jeremiah was ever conceived in his mother's womb, God in eternity had a relationship with Jeremiah. Psalm 139. I'm going to give you the Hebrew translation. God knitted me and embroidered me together in my mother's womb. And all of my parts were written in God's book before any of them came to be. Now, how many of you have children? Raise your hand. How many of you have more than one child? Are they different? Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I got to tell you, the most surprising thing to me about being a parent is how different my three children are. I've got two girls that when they were younger, they looked a lot alike. Couldn't be more different. My oldest daughter, she talks. I don't know where she gets it from. The girl talks. I'd pick her up from school, and just opening the car door was an invitation to an uninterrupted stream of consciousness rendition of virtually everything that had happened at school that day, with nothing too unimportant to be described in exhaustive detail. My youngest daughter, I'd pick her up, and, honey, what'd you do at school today? Stuff. Well, what'd you have for lunch? Food. What'd you do at recess? Play. You know, and I was preaching about a year ago, and my oldest daughter was messing with her hair, and I thought, the girl's 39 years old, and we still can't get her fingers out of her hair. My youngest daughter, I picked her up from seminary once, and she flew in from Southeastern, I said, honey, have you brushed your hair? Oh, I forgot. Princess tomboy. Same mom, same dad, same gene pool, different people. And aren't you different than your siblings? And aren't you grateful? I know I am. I know my wife is. My wife is different than her sister. My oldest daughter asked me one time, she said, Daddy, you think you might have ever had a date with Aunt Kathy? I said, maybe part of one. She looks enough like your mother, we might have had part of a date. But let's put it this way. My wife's sister feels almost as sorry for her sister as I do for my sister-in-law's husband. Same gene pool, different people. Every one of us is unique, and God has a unique purpose and plan for every one of our lives. Now, you know, I've been in the ministry now for 51 years. I've been preaching for 51 years. I started preaching when I was 16 years old. And it's pretty hard to shock me. I mean, I'm pretty much, I've heard most everything. But you know what used to shock me And the first several hundred times, it shocked me. But now I almost expect it. After I speak about the fact that God never created a nobody, and God has a plan and purpose for every child's life, someone will come up to me afterwards and say, "Thank you for defending special children. God sent a special child to our family. And we've learned so much about the really important things in life that we would never have learned had God not sent a special child to us." Now, why did that shock me? Because when my wife told me she was pregnant, I began to pray immediately, "Lord, help that baby to be normal. Help that baby to have all of its fingers and toes, and help that baby to have all of its mental facilities." And yet here are these parents or these siblings coming forward and saying, "Thank you. Thank you for speaking up for special children." Because what a gift. What a gift that's been to our family. That's what separates us from the animals. You know, we have, in the animal kingdom, we have mothers that kill. They'll try to kill the run of the litter. If they'll sense something's wrong with it, they'll kill it. Not human beings. We're different than the animal kingdom. Because of those passages, the Jews did not practice abortion. And when Christianity came into the Roman Empire, it brought the sanctity of life ethic with it. And every time that an abortion takes place, a baby dies. Now let's have none of this nonsense about when does life begin. As Dr. Frist, former Senator Frist, said on the floor of the United States Senate, "Life begins at conception." And that's not a statement of faith. That's a statement of scientific fact. Now, I brought with me a textbook, which I would really encourage all of you, if you're interested in these subjects, to get. This is the most comprehensive textbook that is available dealing with really the tough issues, with the life issues, from a Christian perspective. It's by John Feinberg and Paul Feinberg, Ethics for a Brave New World. And it's, you need to get the second edition because it's been updated and deals with a lot of the issues that deal with cloning and deal with stem cell research. But I just want to read to you from pages 76 and 77, The Physiology of Human Development. This is the diary of an unborn baby. The father's sperm penetrates the mother's egg cell. Genetic instructions from both parents interact to begin a new and unique individual who is no bigger than a grain of sugar. Day one, the first cell divides into two, the two into four, and so on. Day 14. The mother's menstrual period is suppressed by a hormone produced by the baby. Day 18, the heart is forming. Day 20, the beginnings of the brain, the spinal cord, and the nervous system are laid. Day 24, 24 days after conception, the heart begins to beat. Every abortion stops a beating heart. Day 30, the child has grown 10,000 times to about a quarter of an inch long. The brain has human proportions in relation to the rest of the body. Blood flows in the veins and is separate from the mother's blood supply. That's it, 30 days. Most abortions take place after 30 days. Day 35, the mouth, the ears, and the nose are taking shape. Day 40, the heart's energy output is 20% of an adult's output. Day 43, 1.5 months, brain waves can be recorded. Now, they may have brain waves before 43 days, but we can pick them up on an electroencephalogram at 43 days gestation. Most abortions take place after 6 weeks. Day 45, spontaneous movements have begun and the teeth are developing. 7 weeks, lips are sensitive to touch and the ears may already be taking on the family shape. Two months. The child is well proportioned, a small scale baby. Every organ is present. The heart beats sturdily. The stomach produces digestive juices. The liver makes blood cells. The kidneys are functioning. The taste buds are forming. Most babies that are aborted after this. And when they're killed in a saline, they're burned alive with a saline solution abortion, their nervous system feels it. 8.5 weeks, fingerprints are engraved. They will grow larger, but they are unique and will never change. The eyelids and the palms of the hands are sensitive to the touch. At 9 weeks, the child will bend fingers around an object placed in the palm. Thumb sucking begins. Fingernails are forming. At 10 weeks, the body is sensitive to touch. The child squints, swallows, furrows his or her brow, and frowns, and makes complex facial expressions, even smiling. That's 11 weeks. A significant portion of American babies are aborted after 11 weeks. Unfortunately, I've seen them. They are recognizable, tiny, little human beings. And in the United States of America, we have, since 1973, killed 57 million babies. 57 million babies. And God had a plan, and God had a purpose for every one of those babies. Billy Graham is 95 years old and is slipping away from us, I fear. Where's the next Billy Graham? Well, we might have aborted him. There's a 30% chance we've done that. A 30% chance we've killed the next Billy Graham. A 30% chance we've killed the next Martin Luther King Jr. A 30% chance we've killed the next Abe Lincoln. A 30% chance we've killed the person who God was knitting together in her mother's womb to come forth and find the cure for cancer. There's a 100% chance that we've killed 57 million babies and God had a plan and a purpose for everyone. We wonder why God doesn't bless America. I'm shocked that God doesn't judge us more. I'm shocked that God hasn't judged us more severely for practicing child sacrifice. And that's what it is. It's child sacrifice. Speaking of that, reaching out and grasping the hand, do any of you remember the picture of the little baby? They're doing an operation in utero, and they cut into the uterine sac, and the little hand reaches out and grabs the doctor's finger. Remember that? What an incredible picture. Now, this is the kind of issue that I get, or I used to get, as head of the Ethics Commission. The pastors of that couple called me. Here was the situation. They had a baby, and the baby was diagnosed with a genetic condition that could be cured by surgery. If it wasn't fixed, the baby was going to be at least moderately mentally handicapped. At least moderately, because of a malformation in the brain. The doctors could go in and they could fix it, but if the surgery caused the baby to go in, to cause the mother to go into labor, the baby would die because the baby's lungs weren't developed. If they waited until the baby was able to survive outside the womb, it would be too late to do the surgery. So the parents are faced with this dilemma. Do we not give permission for the surgery, and there's a 100% chance that our baby is going to be mentally handicapped? Or do we risk the baby being killed or dying in order to fix this abnormality so that the baby, if it lives, can have a normal life? What do you say? I mean, you know, I had said to myself, well, I got to pray about this one. And as I prayed about it, I said, you know, it says, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. I thought about, if I were that baby, what would I tell my parents to do? Well, I would tell my parents, go for it. Go for it, Mom. Take the shot. I want to have a normal, healthy life. Take the shot. Now, some people have accused me of surrendering to a quality of life ethic. But I would say to you today, right now, if I had a malady and the doctor said to me, now this is personal with me, because for me, the greatest fear I have is not dying. I mean, I have no fear of dying. Well, I actually have some fear of some of the ways you can die. I mean, there are better ways and worse ways. But the actual, you know, dying and going home to be with Jesus, I mean, that doesn't frighten me at all. I mean, look, what should frighten me about death? You know, to die is to have more of him. Paul, who had been taken up into the third heaven, said, I would rather go on home and be with Jesus, but it's better for you that I stay here. I have no fear of death, but if my biggest fear is being alive and being blind. I would rather be in a wheelchair. I'd rather be crippled. If my mind went, I wouldn't know it. But the idea of not being able to use my eyes and not being able to read, not being able to use my eyes, is a terrifying thing to me. If the doctors came to me and they said, you're going blind, and we think we can fix it, but there's a chance it might kill you, I'd say, go for it. Take the shot. Now, that's an individual decision. I don't think anybody else, I don't think that the government doesn't have the right to make that decision for me. But my own decision would be, go for it. Jack Kennedy, in 1954, went through life-threatening back surgery because he was told that if he didn't have it, he would be crippled and be in a wheelchair. And he said, go for it. And he almost died, but he didn't. Okay. We're running a little bit behind, so let me stop now and take questions, and I will run a little bit over in the second one. We'll continue this because I do want to talk about stem cell research, and I want to talk about genetic engineering, and I want to talk about end-of-life issues. because medical science has pushed the boundary of death to the place now where we do need to think about what we want done and what we don't want done. And there's a huge difference between not taking extraordinary measures to extend life, like heart-lung machines, etc., and kidney machines after you're brain dead, as opposed to taking active measures to shorten life, which is always wrong. Okay, any questions? Yes, ma'am. Can you speak up just a little bit? You bet. It's a powerful picture, and it shows the humanity of the unborn baby. We're dealing with human beings. We're dealing with what are recognizably human beings, individual human beings, never to be duplicated human beings. And God has a plan and a purpose for every one of our lives. You may have been a surprise to your parents, but you were not a surprise to God. Yes, sir. Well, now what about their pets? I mean, you know, I've got a German Shepherd dog that's part of the family, so.
Well, I guess I'm talking about the emphasis, the love, mm-hmm. the almost human character that people are giving
them. Yeah. Well, we have a sign at our house that the world's most spoiled, rotten German Shepherd lives here, and he's pretty spoiled. But we do understand the difference between human beings and animals. I think it's pets can be a wonderful comfort. People who have dogs live longer than people who don't. By the way, if you have a cat, it makes no difference. I'm just saying. But if you have a dog, and dogs can be wonderful. You know, they're giving dogs now to wounded veterans, and they have a tremendous therapeutic effect. I mean, dogs are a wonderful gift, And cats, I'm sure, have some purpose. But dogs are a wonderful gift. But they're not human beings, and you know when we blur the line between human beings and animals, what happens is we don't elevate animals; we end up lowering human beings. This is, for instance, in India, where you have Hinduism, which doesn't make this distinction. You have people starving to death on the streets, but they won't kill cows, and they won't kill the rats that are eating the grain because they think they may be killing their uncle, you know, who's been reincarnated. We would have a barbecue and feed the people and kill the rats. Yes, sir.
Do you believe that what you quoted, the Labor Secretary, what's his name?
Reich. Robert Reich.
Has that come to fruition of Obamacare?
It is, yes. Well, look, I've read the bill. It was my job. I read the bill, which most of the congressmen didn't. And there are death panels. There's no question about that. They're going to ration care to the old and the sick. They've already started. They're not giving a cancer drug that has been demonstrated to prolong the lives of women who have stage 4 breast cancer by between 22 to 27 months, and they have ceased to pay for that drug because it's not cost effective. So if you have a wife or a mother or a grandmother who has stage 4 breast cancer, she's going to die 22 to 27 months earlier than she would have before Obamacare came in. They have cut $700 billion out of Medicare to help pay for Obamacare. Well, you cut $700 billion out of Medicare. What does Medicare do? It takes care of people 65 and older. That means you're going to have to wait longer to see a doctor, and you're going to have to wait longer between the time you see a doctor and you get treatment. When you're dealing with that age population, that's often a death sentence. There's no question about it. It is absolutely the case that, and I'll just say this to you without fear of contradiction. Since I have a PhD, I won't say all of you. I'll say 99 out of 100 of you are going to live shorter lives, and your life is going to be filled with more pain and suffering than it would have been had Obamacare not passed. You're going to start seeing more wheelchairs, and you're going to start seeing more crutches, because they're going to give you pain pills and crutches, not hip replacements, because it's cheaper. President Obama himself said about the grandmother who raised him, perhaps it wasn't the best allocation of resources to give her a hip replacement after she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. So I guess she could hobble around with a terribly painful hip while she was dying of cancer. With shepherds like that, you don't need wolves. No, he's not. Yes. Good question. Let me say, first of all, I would not outlaw all abortions. I'm not a pacifist. I believe it is permissible to take life in defense of life, physical life, not emotional well-being, but physical life. Let me give you an example. Once again, I'm the guy who gets these. I had a pastor in South Georgia call me on the phone, and he identified himself, and he said, I'm Pastor so-and-so of such-and-such Baptist church, and I'm here in the emergency room with one of my deacons. His wife has been in a cataclysmic car wreck. She's hovering between life and death. She's in extremely critical condition. And every doctor in the ER is telling us that unless they are allowed to take the baby's life, the mother was 4 months pregnant, not survivable outside the womb, because the baby's lungs had not developed sufficiently. If we don't take this baby, both the mother and the baby are going to die. The baby is too much of a strain. The mother's struggling for life. She's got multiple injuries. Her heart can't take the strain. And my deacon is telling me, preacher, my other three children need their mother. I need my wife. What do I say? Well, what I said was, if it were me, I'd give them permission to take the baby, because the other three children need their mother. And taking life in defense of life is permissible. That's why we are not pacifists. That's why we believe that it's permissible for Christians to be involved in war. It's why we believe that it's permissible for Christians to be involved in the police force. So I would not outlaw all abortions. I would, if I had my way, I would outlaw all abortions except those that are necessary to save the life of the mother. If we had a law that made abortion illegal except to save the life of the mother, we would eliminate about 99.8% of the abortions that take place in the United States every year. In a medically advanced country like the United States, if you take out tubal pregnancies, which of course in a tubal pregnancy, the baby's going to abort anyway. The only question is whether you're going to take the baby before the baby becomes a threat to the mother's future reproductive life or to her life in general. But in a medically advanced country like the United States, it's very seldom an issue. If we had a law that outlawed abortion, except in cases of the mother's life and cases of rape and cases of incest, which I'm not saying we should, but if we did, we would eliminate 98% of the abortions that take place. Only about 2% of the abortions that take place in the United States every year have anything to do with what are called the, quote, troublesome exceptions of rape, incest, and a threat to the mother's life. Now, I personally don't think that rape is a sufficient cause to kill the baby. What's the baby done? Now, I would make the penalty for rape a lot worse. I'd cut the rape rate by about 50%, because about 50% of rapes are done by repeat offenders, and I would make that a biological impossibility. You know, I was asked this question when I was interviewed to be head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. I had a trustee who was pro-choice. And she was not very happy about the prospect of me being elected president, and I can understand that. And she said to me, "Now, it's become very clear to us during our interviews with you that you are particularly close to your oldest daughter," which was true and is true. Princess Jennifer Rebecca, sweetheart, Supergirl, that's what I used to call her. And they said, "What if while you were here in Nashville, your daughter were raped back in Dallas? Wouldn't you want her to have an abortion if she were pregnant?" I said, "Well, you're asking me to choose between my daughter and my granddaughter. My granddaughter's done nothing to deserve to be killed. And you're asking me to significantly endanger my daughter's future reproductive life. Because if a woman aborts her first baby, it significantly reduces the chance that she's going to carry another baby to term." They don't tell you that at the abortion clinic, because if you don't have the abortion, they don't make their money. But an abortion is extremely traumatic to a mother's reproductive system, and it's one of the reasons that we have an epidemic of sterility in this country, because so many American women have had abortions, and then when they want to have a baby, they find that they can't get pregnant because of the trauma that's been done to their reproductive system because they aborted their baby. And if you abort your first baby, it's much worse than subsequent babies. So what I would hope we would do is we'd love our daughter through this and nurture her through this, and then when the baby was born, we'd give it up for adoption through one of our Baptist children's homes so that a childless Baptist couple could have a child to rear and to nurture and the admonition of the Lord, and that baby would have a mother and a father who loves it. Well, then some of my conservative trustees were upset, because how could you give away your own flesh and blood? And I said, because we'd be thinking about what was best for the baby and not what was best for us. Now to the penalty. I think we have to be careful, because abortion has been common for so long that we can't give it the same kind of treatment we would give murder, because there's not an accepted societal definition that it's murder. I would probably give them 1 to 5 years in prison and revoke their medical license. You do that, and you're going to have a hard time finding a doctor who'll do one. You have a hard time sometimes anyway. When Clinton made abortion legal on our military bases overseas, they couldn't find one medical doctor in the armed services who would do one. Bill Clinton said, I can't believe that, and I'm sure he couldn't. When your moral compass is as demagnetized as President Clinton's was, I can understand that. But they couldn't find one medical doctor in the entire armed services that would do an abortion. They had to contract with foreign doctors to come in and do the abortions. For the mother, I would not have a penalty. As far as I'm concerned, a mother who is having an abortion is a victim. She's a victim. In most cases, they didn't get pregnant by themselves. You know, I mean, in fact, in no cases did they get pregnant by themselves. I'm sure we all know that. We're all adults. It's not the result of solitary activity. And I did some work in an abortion clinic, an anti-abortion clinic, you know, trying to save babies. And a crisis pregnancy center. And I was stunned at the number of women that came in whose husbands were insisting they get abortions. I mean, you know, I feel like getting a horse whip and saying, where do you live? I found that in most cases, women who have had abortions feel used, they feel exploited, they feel lied to, because they have been used, they have been exploited, they have been lied to by irresponsible men. And in every case, every way you slice the American people, even if you say, okay, I'm going to take redheaded people, redheaded women who live in New York City who are over 6 feet tall. Small group. There'd be more pro-life women than pro-abortion women. Women in every category are more pro-life than men are. Because women have the babies. They know it's a human being. And too many men in our culture look upon abortion as a way to escape responsibility for their actions. So I would not penalize women. I've seen too many women with post-traumatic stress syndrome. I would penalize the doctors, if it weren't the doctors, whoever's doing the abortion is the person I would penalize. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break.